today on Against the Grain. What's happened to political protest as capitalism goes through what's called the logistics revolution? What is logistics, and has it made corporations more or less vulnerable to militant actions like strikes and blockades? I'm CS. Jasper Burns describes the phenomenon of logistical globalization and what protest blockades can accomplish in the face of it. Coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Capitalism as a system is dynamic. It changes and adapts and remakes itself over time in ways often designed to facilitate profit-taking and to disempower those who want to reform or dismantle the capitalist system. One key change in the way capitalists operate has been effected by what's called the logistics revolution, a dramatic shift in the way retailers and other firms approach the all-important task of producing and storing and transporting commodities. Whereas before, businesses would amass inventories of goods that would then be drawn upon as customer orders came in, the focus has increasingly turned toward just-in-time production, on making commodities after or as they are ordered. The logistics revolution, as Jasper Burns sees it, has been good for corporate efficiency and profits, but it also has made businesses more vulnerable to protests at places like freeways and ports, along which and through which goods flow to their destinations. Protests at these sites often take the form of blockades, which Burns sees as a crucial tactic wielded by resistance movements in the contemporary moment. Jasper Burns is an independent scholar who has taught at Stanford, UC Berkeley, University of San Francisco, and San Francisco Art Institute. He edits Commune Editions, and he's author of The Work of Art in the Age of Deindustrialization. When Jasper Burns joined me recently in studio, I asked him how prevalent the protest blockade has become.
I think it's become enormously prevalent. You know, maybe 5 or 7 years back when I began to make these arguments about the shift from the strike to the blockade, there was a lot of skepticism about them. And I think the intervening time has really brought an immense amount of confirmation to these ideas. Every year, it seems, there's a new movement that is centered around the blockade, and it really has become the tactic of choice, the central item in what we might call the tactical repertoire of our time. And of course, there are other important tactics and other important developments, but I think blockades are what people reach for when they are looking for a way to make themselves effective.
And what kinds of people? Can you give us some examples of movements in this country and perhaps elsewhere that have utilized the blockade?
Well, I think that the two examples that come to mind are Black Lives Matter and the No Dapple movement at Standing Rock. Black Lives Matter used all kinds of tactics and did all kinds of things, but one of the most kind of remarkable events during the unfolding of Black Lives Matter was this moment when there were over kind of 70 freeway blockades and people took to the freeway, shutting them down, you know, in cities all across the country and continued to do so whenever there was a new event or a new cause to protest. By the same measure, in a very different way, the blockade was a kind of central element in the protest at Standing Rock. People were blockading the pipeline, trying to shut it down. They were also sabotaging the machinery that Dakota Access was using to kind of build the pipeline. But, you know, it very much was a blockade. It was a blockade of the roads to keep workers from getting into the site. You know, it was a blockade of the pipeline site itself.
How have blockades been deployed, for example, in France and in Mexico?
In France, there have been movements since about 2005 that have placed the blockade at their center. And there you get a kind of alliance between the blockade and the strike. So you'll have workers, say, at an oil refinery kind of shutting it down and going on strike, but then you'll have people who are part of the larger movement in solidarity with the strikers, you know, say a movement against a change to pension law or some other change to labor law, which is often the case. You'll get people from the surrounding area kind of helping to keep that workplace shut down and keep other people being brought in to open it back up. And then you'll get roving, they call them piquet volant, flying pickets that will move around the city, shutting down various kinds of sites. So there you get a sort of a mixture that allies the blockade and the strike. In Mexico, I think there are a lot of ways that you see the blockade, but you know, frequently in movements that are protesting conditions down there, they will shut down a highway. Sometimes they'll kind of demand money from people passing by, or they'll merely shut it down. And I think, you know, notably the kind of tragedy at Ayotzinapa started with a blockade, right? Those students had shut down the road that day. So, you know, it's just an incredibly common tactic these days, and, you know, not just in highly kind of developed countries like the U.S. or France, but all over the world.
What has deindustrialization done to the ability of workers to strike, to wield the traditional weapon of militant workers?
Well, I mean, the main thing that it's done is it's taken away the kinds of workplaces that were really easy to shut down with strikes, places where you had semi-skilled workers brought together in large numbers, such as a factory, right? The thing about the factory is that you have a large number of workers who are able to kind of network together and organize together. And they're also workers who aren't very easily replaced. They have some skills that need to be learned over a period of time. They're not highly skilled workers, but they're what are called semi-skilled workers. And so that allows workers in such a site to kind of wield immense power, right? It's very hard for the operations of the company to go on without them. And so, you know, that was a kind of a lever that the working class used to exact concessions from the bosses for close to a century. Now, as deindustrialization has unfolded, those workplaces are farther and fewer between. There's less workers working in them, and instead people are working in the kinds of places, say, kind of a retail shop or a restaurant or in a transportation network that are much harder to organize and much harder to use as kind of leverage against employers.
Joshua Clover has used the term circulation struggles. What does he mean by that?
He means struggles that take as their area of action the space of circulation where goods and people are moving about. So he would oppose those to kind of struggles that focus on the worksite, the place of production, and instead struggles that unfold in the marketplace and the roads, in transportation networks. So a riot would be an example of a circulation struggle because it doesn't have its object as the factory or the workplace. A blockade would also be a circulation struggle. So circulation struggle is a category that incorporates the blockade, but some other tactics as well.
So in your writings, you place the emergence of the blockade and other tactical shifts in tactics among protest movements, within the context of an ongoing restructuring of capital and of capitalism, superintended, you write, by the so-called logistics revolution. So let's talk about logistics. How would you define logistics in the business world?
So logistics is a term and a concept that comes first and foremost from the military, right? Logistics is the kind of science or the study of how to move people and goods around most efficiently and effectively. And this was something that, you know, militaries have had to do for thousands of years. Military campaigns have been won or lost based upon their management of logistics. In the 20th century, corporations began to kind of look to the military for ways to understand how they might be themselves more effective at moving people and goods around, and began to kind of incorporate this kind of logistics study in order to be much more effective and efficient in transporting goods, transporting people, and making sure that you didn't have goods sitting on the shelves for any extended period of time or sitting in factories for any extended period of time. Because, of course, the longer anything is kind of sitting around before it's moved to the next point down the chain, the more money is being lost.
So in other words, the traditional notion of kind of a standing inventory where you make goods, you put them somewhere, and then you wait for people to order or purchase them, and then you move it from your, say, warehouse to the place of retail, for example, that's superseded because logistics doesn't see that as lean enough?
It's not efficient, because the way that capitalists look at their business is that they are concerned with how much revenue they make on their investment. And the longer you have your money tied up in goods, the more money you have invested for a longer period of time. And so if inventory is kind of sitting there on the shelves or in the place of sale, then it's actually a kind of investment that is tied up for longer. So it's going to actually decrease your profit rate. So there's a lot of emphasis on kind of lowering the amount of money and investment that is tied up and freeing up more money to be, you know, sent to other parts of the world or to other kinds of operations. And this is something that is taken to a certain extent from the kind of Toyota production system that was put in place by kind of Japanese auto manufacturers, and particularly Toyota, starting in the 1970s. And they sort of looked at any standing inventory as a kind of form of waste. It's just like throwing away, you know, one-tenth of the apple instead of using it. Having inventory standing around is a form of waste. It's a waste of time, as it were. And you can increase your profits by making everything flow faster.
What does just-in-time mean, and is this part of the logistics revolution?
Yeah, just-in-time is basically another name for what I was just describing as the Toyota production system, generalized to the whole economy. So Toyota came up with a just-in-time system, and instead of having inventory standing around waiting to be used, they only produced inventory as it was needed, or as close to the moment when it's needed as possible, so that everything is arriving exactly as it's ready to be used or ready to be sold to the consumer. Of course, this is an ideal. It's something that firms can only approach approximately. You're always going to have some inventory, you know, sitting around. But that's the goal.
Jasper Burns joins me. He's an independent scholar. He's author of The Work of Art in the Age of Deindustrialization. He edits Commune Editions, and he joins me to talk mostly about a paper he wrote about logistics and counter-logistics in the age of walled flows. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So capitalism relies on supply chains, right? So there are suppliers and, you know, obviously people who manufacture things, corporations, companies, outfits, and they supply products, commodities to, for example, retailers who then put things for sale, whether online or in brick and mortar structures. What does logistics and the logistics revolution do to the relative power of actors on and within the supply chain?
The logistics revolution has had a number of different effects, and it's different in different industries. But one of the things you often see is power shifts from the manufacturer to the retailer. Walmart is a great example. Walmart has enormous power over its suppliers to determine what's being produced, how much it's being produced for, when it's produced. And so Walmart is, in fact, the kind of center of that economic network. And so instead of the manufacturers having power in the economy and determining what's being sold and when it's being sold and then just, you know, giving it to the retailers, in fact, Walmart contracts out to a whole network of suppliers and makes sure that things are being produced exactly according to its specifications and according to its terms. And then those suppliers themselves go to other kind of networks of suppliers and so on and so forth down the chain. But the locus of power is kind of shifted to the retailer in this situation. Amazon is another great example. Amazon has enormous power over the market, but it doesn't itself produce anything, just like Walmart doesn't itself produce anything. Apple would be another great example. Apple doesn't actually manufacture its phones directly. It contracts the manufacturing out to other companies like Foxconn. And so the locus of power has really moved toward the seller rather than the maker.
And what does that mean for workers along the supply chain and whether the logistics revolution had something to do with what capital wanted to do in relation to and to labor?
The logistics industry has given companies an enormous amount of power over labor and over workers. So one of the things that happens when you get a company like Walmart that is producing through contract manufacturers is that they no longer have any commitment to the people who are making stuff for them. They can always go to another contract manufacturer at another moment. So it gives capitalists an enormous amount of power to shift from one work site to another if they don't like the terms they're being given, right? And it weakens the power of workers to be able to demand things from those companies, right? And another thing it does, it establishes a number of kinds of mediating links between workers and the companies that are setting conditions for them. So it's very, you know, it's very difficult for, say, workers who are ultimately producing a shoe for Nike to have any power over Nike because there's three different kind of layers between them and the company and between them and any consumer. So it keeps their responsibility to workers at arm's length. And it allows them to kind of fragment the workforce, to pit certain workers against other workers. And it just, you know, has enormously increased the kind of capitalist power over workers and over the working class. And I think is a large, one of the real reasons why we see, you know, wages where they are today.
Are there other reasons, well, you're implying so, that capital reorganized itself in the direction of logistics and ever more sophisticated logistics techniques?
Yes. It did it in response to the kinds of resistance it was meeting from workers in the middle of the 20th century. And it did it also because there weren't the same opportunities to make profits in the manufacturing sector. So those two things together have produced the kind of situation for workers that we have today, which is, I think, as probably most of your listeners know, not a great one. You know, most people haven't seen a real increase in their wages in many decades.
There is also a logistics industry. What does this comprise?
So the logistics industry would be third-party providers of logistics services. They provide a service to other firms, and they manage the distribution of goods for those firms. So they will, you know, connect suppliers with customers. They will move things, you know, from one site to another, and they'll try to kind of do things more efficiently for a company. So instead of shipping goods directly, you can hire another firm to take over that work.
What you were saying about logistics helping corporations deal with the downturn of the 1970s. So are you saying that, because a lot of people focus on financialization as, you know, the response to the downturn of the 70s, the reduced profit-taking and profit-making on the part of capital, but you're saying that this trend, what, is as important as financialization?
Yeah, I would say it is as important as financialization. And in many ways, it's the obverse of financialization. It's the other side of the coin. Financialization is concerned with getting investment money to the places where it needs to be invested. And then that money is, you know, ideally, in the way the credit system is supposed to work, it's going to finally get invested into factories and buying raw materials and paying workers. But then on the other end, you're going to produce a bunch of things and you need to then get those products to the consumer. So logistics is the other side of that process of circulation. And financialization and logistics have both been transformed in this period in order to kind of increase profits. In both cases, you want to reduce the amount of money that you have to leave standing there for any amount of time.
What impact did the logistics revolution have on the use of transport and shipping and on the costs of transport and shipping?
Well, it reduced costs of transport immensely. I think a lot of people will know about the importance of the container and the container ship. It's a technical innovation that has allowed the amount of the volume of goods that are being sent from one part of the world to another to explode. So it has massively reduced the cost of transporting a certain commodity.
Could you talk more about the way business logistics follows and replicates a military model and the way in which logistics still reflects a kind of military logic?
Yes, this is something that's really interesting. There's always been this intimate link between the logistics industry and the military. Obviously, it comes from the military originally, but at every turn, the military seems to have been involved. So the first use of the container, the kind of first experiments with using the container as a technology, occurred in Vietnam and were used by the kind of army to explore getting materials to Vietnam. And it's only through that kind of test that then firms began to invest in this way of shipping goods. By the same measure, Walmart's use of radio frequency ID tags to kind of be able to monitor shipments as they pass around the world was something that was first promoted by the U.S. Army during the war in Iraq. So, and a lot of the main logistics executives at Walmart have a background in the military, particularly the Air Force. So there's always this kind of transfer of knowledge and sometimes personnel from the military to the logistics industry. And I think I would argue that kind of a transfer of a certain mindset as well.
Jasper Burns joins me in studio. He has taught at Stanford University, UC Berkeley, University of San Francisco, and San Francisco Art Institute. He has a PhD in English from UC Berkeley. We are talking about a paper he wrote and presented. It's called Logistics and Counter-Logistics in the Age of Walled Flows. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Okay, so this emphasis on kind of the quick and continuous flow of goods and commodities, what does that emphasis do to the power of the blockade, to corporate America's vulnerability to the blockade?
Well, when firms begin to rely on logistics and they begin to kind of fragment their supply chains and their networks, and the commodity has suppliers all over the world, and there are all sorts of movements that go into making that commodity, those companies are really vulnerable to any kind of disruption in that supply chain. Right, there are so many things that can go wrong. If you have, you know, an iPhone that is sourced from over 300 different components, and those components are produced in 300 different places, right? And if you can't get one of those things, you can't make the iPhone, right? So the logistics revolution has increased the power of these firms over workers, but it's also increased their vulnerability to certain kinds of disruptions and their vulnerability, I would argue, to blockades, right? They are dependent upon these transportation networks. And when it comes to really kind of critical components or key elements, the shutdown of one link in that chain can end up making it so that the firm can't produce the thing at all.
And it's one thing to say that corporate America is more vulnerable because of logistics. It's another thing to say that social movements understand this vulnerability and are taking advantage of it via the blockade. Do you think that there is actually a strategic consideration by some of the protesters, or many of them that you've mentioned, to take advantage of logistics and the priority it's being given by capital?
I do, but I don't think that it's always fully worked out. I think that there is a way in which movements are a kind of learning, and they produce a kind of knowledge that is provisional and partial, and that nobody has, you know, access to completely. But there is, I think, a kind of activist common sense about where one might be effective and be powerful. And I think that as, you know, people look around the world in which they live and they begin to think about how they might be effective, how they might be able to kind of bring things to a halt in order to win their demands, they naturally seize upon these logistical linkages. So one example would be the sort of shutdown of the port by Occupy Oakland in 2012. That's something that happened kind of spontaneously, and it really was out of just a kind of recognition by that movement that that was a site where they could be powerful. And I think you see this again and again and again. I think there's clearly a consciousness of the power of that oil pipeline by the kind of Standing Rock movement. It absolutely understands the kind of political economy of the oil pipeline and how it can be sort of effective in bringing that to a halt. So, you know, different movements will understand different things, but I do think that this is a consensus that has been solidifying over the last few years.
You referred earlier to the freeway blockades in over 70 cities after the non-indictment of the police officer who killed Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. What do you want to say about freeway blockades and what they represent and what they accomplish or don't accomplish?
Well, I think the freeway blockades are inspiring, and I think they are an incredibly powerful statement of a need to make everything in the world stop, stop and recognize what is happening in this country, recognize the kind of the trauma of policing and the kind of institution of the police. And so I think they are a meaningful tactic. But of course, at the same time, there are probably more effective, more important areas to shut down than a freeway. And, you know, a lot of the people who are being shut down by that freeway blockade are just ordinary people who are trying to get to work. It's not as if you're actually shutting down the institution of the police or shutting down a kind of powerful company. And I recognize the limitations there and the weakness of that tactic in that sense. At the same time, I think that people need to find some way of making their power felt. And, you know, for many movements, that's just what's available to them. And I think that, you know, what I hope is that that will be part of this process of learning and that will be a kind of a stepping stone on the way to a kind of a more effective blockade, kind of sharpening of the tactic, as it were.
You've written that freeways are not seen by urban residents only as flows.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the whole freeway system as it was formed in the 20th century was part of a kind of remaking of the city and explicitly racist and racialized lines. All of these kinds of freeways in cities like Oakland and Houston and New York essentially had the effect of segregating populations. And so they're hardly innocuous. And I think that, you know, there is a reason why people might want to kind of bring them to a halt at that moment.
Jasper Burns is his name. He's an independent scholar. He's author of The Work of Art in the Age of Deindustrialization and of two books of poetry, Stars Down and We Are Nothing and So Can You. We'll take a short break and speak more with Jasper about logistics and the politics of it and the blockade, the protest blockade. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Jasper Burns joins me. He is an independent scholar. He edits Commune Editions. And he has written and presented a paper that I found out about. It's called Logistics and Counterlogistics in the Age of Walled Flows. And I'm happy he joins me in our Berkeley studios to talk about it. So, you know, we focused a lot on logistics as encouraging, promoting a kind of fluidity and agility. You write, however, that logistics is not just flow, but it's also wall. How so?
Well, this is something I've been thinking about recently with the election of Donald Trump. And I think there's one way that we might think about logistics and globalization that's very common. And this would run something like this. We think that logistics is just kind of opening up the world. It's creating kind of new networks and new connections everywhere. All borders are kind of overrun or done away with. This is a kind of cliche of the free market. Logistics is just the kind of freeing up of all flows so that, you know, everything is allowed to move everywhere. But that's not really how it works. In fact, when a firm sets up a kind of logistical network, it's always in competition with other firms. So it's always kind of edging and trying to kind of muscle out other potential competitors, right? Its kind of military character is hardwired into it. So logistical networks are always kind of highly militarized and securitized. They're all about flow and movement, but they're also about a kind of a channeled flow, a flow with walls, right? And that's why when you go to a port, it's kind of managed by Homeland Security, and there's, you know, giant electrified fences with barbed wire. And these are spaces that are, you know, completely militarized. And that's part of the nature of the entire kind of supply chain. And so, you know, it would be a mistake to just think about it as kind of this form of openness, of connection. It's also about closing things down, walling things off, blocking things off. And so this can help us to understand the kind of nature of logistics in the age of Trump a little bit better if we sort of move away from that sort of cliched image of what's happening in globalization.
Can you give us an example of a channel or a corridor opened up by logistics, logistical globalization, that you think illustrates some of what you're talking about and perhaps also indicates how nation states are acting differently with respect to trade than maybe they were before?
Well, there are a lot of examples of this, and there are geographers and sociologists working in the area of logistics study that have written really extensively about this and done really kind of powerful studies of the ways in which logistical networks are militarized. One example that comes to mind is Deborah Cowan, whose book, The Deadly Life of Logistics, really just focuses on the kind of imbrication between a certain war on terror logic and the logistics industry. And she talks about these, they're called gateway and corridor initiatives. And really they're about opening up borders in certain very controlled ways. So goods will say come from China into Vancouver, into the west coast of Canada, and they'll be fast-tracked through the border. They'll already be kind of pre-approved when they leave China. And then they can pass through Canada directly into the U.S., also fast-tracked, right? And they can pass right through the border without stopping. But at the same time, if you want to cut transversally or laterally across that corridor, you're going to find those gigantic barbed wire fences, and you're going to find a kind of a lot of military force, right? So certain things are fast-tracked, but everything else is walled off. It's sort of like when you go to the airport, right? There are people who've paid a little bit of extra money for their kind of priority or their VIP service, and they walk right through without any kinds of checks. And at the same time, you know, other people are being, you know, brought into some other kind of room and interrogated and searched. And that's really the kind of world we have, is that certain flows are accelerated and other flows are, you know, cut off.
Well, you said that goods moving through this corridor they'll get into Vancouver, but then they'll go straight from Canada to the U.S. Well, how does that happen? How does the U.S., doesn't the U.S. want to check those goods at the Canada-U.S. border?
there'll be a, what happens is that U.S. Customs agents will be in collaboration with the Canadian customs officials. And so I think sometimes you actually have U.S. customs officials in Canada working there and signing off on the thing. So it's, you know, in some countries, I don't know if you've noticed this, but there's been a few times where I've flown back to the United States and you'll go through customs before you come into the United States. This happens with Canada, right? You kind of pass through. There's U.S. customs agents working in Canada. So borders are weird things. They're kind of these, they're not really, we have this idea of thinking of a border as this kind of imaginary line with no width that you just kind of pass through. And, you know, at one moment you're on one side of the border and at another moment you're on another side of the border. That's not really how they work. Actually, they have a lot of width. They have a lot of thickness and borders can kind of penetrate, you know, for hundreds of miles. So you can be at the border and be, you know, inside an airport, you know, hundreds of miles in the interior of a country. And so borders are much stranger these days than you would think.
What's your sense of how Donald Trump has, what stance he has taken in relation to logistical globalization? What stance he has taken in relation to the flow of capital and goods that has been promoted by logistics?
This is the thing I've been trying to figure out, and it's something I started asking myself during the Trump campaign. So, you know, on the one hand, Trump and the people around him have taken a number of kind of highly visible stances with regard to globalization that are very negative, right? Trump is, you know, he wants to back out of NAFTA. He wants to impose tariffs on goods coming from China. He wants to renationalize production and bring, you know, manufacturing back to the United States. And in some sense, he sort of positions himself as a kind of classic economic nationalist, right? This is Steve Bannon's term for, you know, his vision of the Trump moment. And, you know, I always thought that was probably not real. It's not real in a number of ways. It's never going to happen, right? There's no way that the companies that control the American economy are ever going to let a president like Trump, you know, impose massive tariffs on Chinese goods. That's just never going to happen. But I always thought there was a kind of some kind of conflict within the Trump administration around these things. And you can see the difference between, you know, say a kind of Rex Tillerson and a Steve Bannon. You know, now Steve Bannon is out, but I was beginning to think about this stuff in the early moment when there was, you know, it seemed as if there was an economic nationalist wing of the Trump administration and then a kind of much more conventional Republican, we might call it neoliberal wing, that was pretty much positive about globalization. And I thought that the latter wing, the Tillerson wing, would win, which it has, I think, in many ways. But I wanted to understand what, you know, what would happen, what could happen, what would an economic nationalism look like if it were really able to succeed. And I knew it wouldn't be, you know, just bringing all the factories back and closing the borders. That's not going to happen. But really what might happen is instead of a kind of deglobalization, right, a kind of nationalization of the economy, what you might have is a kind of reglobalization. That is, the use of these logistical networks to kind of position the United States differently with respect to other kinds of countries. So maybe what's happening, or maybe what could happen, or maybe what the political elites might try to do is, say, pivot away from China toward Russia, you know, or, you know, move the U.S. with logistics into some kind of collaboration with kind of northern countries like Canada and Russia in order to monopolize oil resources in the Arctic as it starts to thaw. That's the kind of thing you're going to see happening. And that's not globalization. That is just a different kind of globalization. And it's, so what we're going to see is globalization as war, as a kind of competition between national blocks. And this is, I think, the direction things are going. But that plays on powers that have always been an aspect of logistics. That plays on the kind of militarized, security-based aspect of logistics. It's always been there. There have always been these walls there. And this would just be a kind of proliferation of those walls.
Jasper Burns is my guest, B-E-R-N-E-S. He, as I mentioned earlier, has taught at a number of institutions, including Stanford and UC Berkeley. He's author of The Work of Art in the Age of Deindustrialization, and we are talking about his research into logistics and counter-logistics under contemporary capitalism and the blockade, the protest blockade, as it has emerged as a prevalent weapon among social movements. What do you think about what you've said about possible re-globalization under Trump? Where does that relate to, or how might that relate to Trump's positions on immigrants?
This is also something I'm still trying to figure out, and I've been watching the kind of development of this horrifying discourse very closely. You know, obviously, the Trump administration has this problem, right? It needs to sell this kind of nativist, racist, anti-immigrant language in order to mobilize its base. But at the same time, it knows that the American economy depends upon immigrant labor. You know, it hears that every day from the kinds of business leaders it's beholden to. And so I don't think that the Trump administration is going to, you know, simply close off all kind of flows of immigrant labor into the United States. That's impossible. And anyway, there's more people leaving the country now than are coming in, you know, because of the nature of the economy. So the wall that Trump wants to build, it's not really about keeping people out. It's about controlling them as they come in and making sure that they're highly watched, that they're paranoid, that they're afraid to ask for anything, and that they're constantly kind of under threat. And that makes for a kind of a workforce, an immigrant workforce that is more pliable, that is more exploitable, and that is, you know, more conducive to American industry as the Trump administration imagines it. So again, it's not really about a wall or a flow. It's about a certain kind of walled flow. It's about controlling those conduits and those channels in order to make sure that people are kind of kept in line.
Now, a lot of workers are kept in line, but some workers, you have written, have a lot of power in today's logistical world. Which workers are they?
Well, I think that workers who inhabit these kind of critical nodes in transportation networks have an enormous amount of power to shut things down. You know, an example would be the dock workers at the ports. If they go on strike, things really grind to a halt, and the economy loses millions upon millions of dollars every hour. And they have an enormous amount of power. Some kind of left-wing theorists place an enormous emphasis on that power, and they think that left strategy should orient itself almost completely toward that power. It's if we should just try to kind of mobilize people who work in warehouses and at ports and drive trucks, and that if we just kind of organize that very small sector of the working class, we'll be able to win. I think that's a terrible idea personally, because I think that it's an incredibly tiny fraction of the workforce. And, you know, if you ever have a tiny fraction of the workforce, it would be very easy for those people to be kind of neutralized or, you know, bought off or otherwise evaded by the powers that be. You know, a left revolution or social movement that's going to produce change, it has to be massive. It has to involve many, many, many people, and not just the people that are lucky enough to find themselves in a place where they can, you know, exert a lot of power. So I don't like that sort of strategy, which we might call substitutionist, as a term that sometimes gets used, right? Those people kind of substitute for the energy of the masses. I'm not saying, of course, we should use their power as much as we can. I just don't think we should rely on it or place all our hopes in that basket, as it were.
Are the blockades effected by Black Lives Matter or the water protectors at Standing Rock, are they designed merely to cut off the flow of, say, oil or of highway traffic?
Well, this is the kind of conceptual reframing that I'd propose here. A way that we might think about these blockades is that they're not just blockades. They actually are themselves a kind of movement or a flow. No blockade is just a simple negation or a simple interruption of some already existing movement. It is itself a movement. So when a march goes onto the freeway and it shuts down traffic, it's also opening up a way for itself. It's also cutting across the kinds of structures that society has placed in front of it, right? And in the same way, you know, I'm by no means an expert about the Standing Rock struggle, but you know, my understanding of Native American history is that these are people who've been enormously walled in and blockaded themselves by the kinds of structures of the American economy. The pipeline is itself a blockade of that community, is in itself an interruption of their ways of life. So when they shut it down, they're actually opening up ways for themselves to live, right? The blockade, the reason why they don't want the pipeline is because it's going to kind of pollute the flow of the Missouri River, right, which is itself this kind of form of free flow. So, you know, there's always at stake both a kind of interruption and a flow. I know I'm getting a little special or poetic here, but what I would like to propose is that we think of every blockade as itself a kind of a flow. Every blockade is an affirmation of one flow and a kind of negation of another. And if we start to think about things that way, then the blockade doesn't look as negative as we might sometimes see it. I think that people have a hard time with the kind of purely negative character of certain tactics, like, oh, you're just shutting this thing down. What are you for? What are you about? Well, actually, blockades are about a lot of things, and they have a positive character, and they have a positive vision. And I think that we can kind of help to bring that out.
The police, they hate blockades. Why do they hate? I mean, obviously, you know, we could understand that they're disrupting business as usual, transportation as usual. But in your theoretical lens, why might police and police unions be so upset with blockades?
Well, I tell a story that's a little bit psychological, but I think it's pretty plausible. When you're a police officer, you get to turn on your sirens and your lights, and you get to drive down the road as fast as you want, and everybody has to get out of the way for you. You have an enormous amount of power over society, and your power over society is, you know, affected by the highway, right? And so somebody's standing along a highway and refusing to move, even when your lights and your sirens are on, even when you're pointing a gun at them, even when you're threatening them with pepper spray and all kinds of other violence. That's an incredible affront to their social power. That's an incredible refusal of the power that they're given. And I think it just drives cops out of their mind. They hate it.
Yeah, it's not so much theoretical, but it makes perfect sense, yeah, as a practical matter and as an indication of the power that the police feel that all of a sudden is negated by people blockading, for example, a roadway. To what extent have lawmakers in the U.S. tried to impose penalties upon those who blockade roads or have tried to make it easier for motorists and police to break up blockades?
Well, we live in a moment when right-wing lawmakers are aligned in an incredibly deep way with the police and with the consciousness of police. And I think that affront to authority is something that a lot of lawmakers themselves feel. And so there have been, you know, laws proposed and in some cases passed in numerous states after Black Lives Matter and after Standing Rock. There have been all kinds of attempts to criminalize blockades, to criminalize blocking the road, to allow in a more extreme use of violence. I think there have been laws in Minnesota, in the Dakotas, in North Carolina, all over. A lot of them have failed, I think, because they're already actually quite vigorous laws to prosecute this kind of behavior or this kind of, you know, tactic by social movements. But yeah, I think that there is a reaction to the power of these social movements that is, you know, starts with the police and starts around the police, but is taken up by lawmakers, by Trump himself.
What do you want to say about one notorious attempt to break through a kind of blockade? And that was when James Alex Fields drove his car at a crowd of anti-racist protesters in Charlottesville in August, and among other things, killed Heather Heyer.
Well, I mean, it's hard to know what to say. It's horrifying. I was horrified when it happened, and I'm still horrified And this might sound kind of crass, and I don't want to sound that way, but I was also not surprised. I remember in the week leading up to Charlottesville, I had numerous conversations where I said to friends, you know, I just really hope no one is killed. I was not surprised that someone was killed. These people, these kind of alt-right, neo-fascist people are, you know, they're really clear about their desire to kill other people and their willingness to do so. And I think that driving your car through a crowd of protesters is something that, you know, supporters of the police, and I think the police themselves in many instances have talked about, have fantasized about, have written about. There are segments on Fox News where they kind of put together a collage of people driving cars through protest blockades. I've been at many protests where people have driven their cars into the crowds and injured people. Usually it happens at, you know, 5 or 10 or 15 miles per hour. What was different about this was that somebody did it at such incredible speed. But I think that this is a touchstone within the right now, this desire to run people over. And I think it speaks to this kind of police mentality. It's horrifying, and I think we can see how it's a response to the power of these movements. And I hope the lesson we take from it is to keep going and keep doing that.
What do you find significant about the fact that the car James Alex Fields was driving was a Dodge Challenger?
Well, the Challenger is, and I've written a little bit about this, it's a remake of a kind of classic muscle car. And the muscle car, in some sense, it is a emblem of this kind of industrial moment in the United States. And it's an emblem of a certain kind of American golden age that I think these alt-right characters, you know, look back fondly to. They imagine the 1960s as this kind of time where, you know, whites were in power, where men were in power, and they want to go back there. Of course, that's not really how it was, but I think the muscle car is a kind of symbol of that for them. So it's not surprising. And I wrote about this. I wrote about the Challenger, and numerous people said to me, yeah, it's always, whenever I see a Challenger on the road, that person is always such a jerk.
Jasper Burns, again, B-E-R-N-E-S, independent scholar, PhD in English from UC Berkeley. He edits Commune Editions. He's written two books of poetry called Stars Down and We Are Nothing and So Can You. And he's author of The Work of Art in the Age of Deindustrialization. Again, he has written about logistics and counter-logistics in the age of walled flows. Thank you, Jasper, for your work and for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.